Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova. Hey guys, welcome back. We hope you're staying safe and relatively sane during these crazy times. Today we've got Donald Hoffman on the show. He's a cognitive psychologist who studies consciousness, visual perception, and evolutionary psychology. He's the author of several books, and the latest one being The Case Against Reality. In this interview, we talk about Donald's scientific theory of consciousness, which he calls conscious realism. We discuss why we don't see reality as it is, what experiments demonstrate this, and the role of spiritual practices in how we perceive reality. For all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/123. And to access the full episode, become a member at members.futurethinkers.org.
Before we get into the show, we have a special announcement. Our past podcast guest and friend, Chris Beasley, is going to be giving a 3-week workshop starting April 21st. It's called The Busy Trap. In this workshop, Chris will guide you to overcoming the drive to always be busy and help you find freedom from worry and anxiety. This workshop is for basic and premium members only. To register, go to futurethinkers.org/busy. See you inside. Now let's get into the show. Hi, Donald. Welcome to the show. We're very happy to have you.
Thank you very much, and it's good to be with you.
Cool. So I've been watching a bunch of your lectures and started on your book, and Mike has almost finished it. So I thought that your theories were very different from what is in the mainstream science right now, but at the same time, I found them to be very intuitive. And there's a lot that overlaps with my own insights that I've had in meditation. There's something about this idea of consciousness being primary and everything else arising in consciousness that that seems to come as a common insight with doing a lot of meditation. So I was wondering if how you came to have these theories and if you have your own contemplative practice or if it was from something else.
Yes, I do have my own meditative practice, but it's only been for the last 17 years. So I started working on this idea that consciousness is fundamental long before I took seriously the idea of even meditating at all. And it was primarily because of certain scientific problems that we were having in my field. I'm in cognitive neuroscience, and we study brain activity and its relationship to human behavior and human perception and emotion and intelligence and so forth. And we're quite successful. It's remarkable how many aspects of human cognition we can explain. Learning, memory, problem solving, intelligence, language acquisition. We're getting to the point where we can, ideas that have come out of cognitive neuroscience and computational vision have led to robotic cars, that can drive themselves and so forth. So it's been spectacularly successful, but there's one problem where we have utterly failed. And that's where you would think it would be the most simple, which is just basic experiences like the taste of vanilla, the smell of a rose. These very elementary conscious experiences seem to elude us. We have many examples of neural correlates of these experiences. So, we can have tight correlations between color experience and activity in area V4 of visual cortex and motion experience and area V5 activity and so forth. But we've not been able to come up with a scientific theory that starts with neural activity as an unconscious physical process and with mathematical precision boot up a specific conscious experience like the taste of chocolate or something like that. We simply can't do it. There's not a single neuroscience theory or computer science theory, that does it with maybe some kind of a computer program that starts with a program or a neuroscience model of some architecture in the brain and its activity, and without a hand wave gives you the precise conditions in which a specific conscious experience like the taste of vanilla arises and explains exactly why that taste must arise from that kind of neural activity or that kind of program and why it couldn't be the smell of chocolate or, a headache or something like that. And it was that utter failure of science in my field to solve that, what seems like a simple problem, that has really made me step back and question the very foundations of the field, right? And this is not unusual. It's quite common for a scientific theory to be spectacularly successful in a wide range of domains, and yet have a couple little that look like little areas where it's falling apart. And history has repeatedly shown us that when you pay attention to where the theories fall apart, that's where you get your biggest insights. So Newton's theory of physics was spectacularly successful in almost everything for centuries, but it couldn't deal with something called the Michelson-Morley experiments, where light, the behavior of light wasn't what we expected. It didn't seem to change its speed. And something called black body radiation, where things were glowing when they heated up in a way that wasn't predicted by Newton. And for many physicists, this was just, oh, these are little minor things, Newton is good. But it turned out, when we took those problems seriously, Michelson-Morley experiment pointed the way to Einstein's theory of relativity, and the black box radiation, black body radiation, pointed the way to quantum theory and quantum field theory. And those were revolutionary. And so that's my attitude about cognitive neuroscience. It's spectacularly successful at almost everything. That means it's getting a lot, in some sense, very, very right. But we're very wise to look at where it's falling down, and it falls down dramatically on consciousness. And so that's why I focus there. And the reason I decided to take consciousness as fundamental instead of space, time, and physical objects like neurons was that it was the only way I could think of to solve this scientific problem. If I can't start with unconscious physical systems, computers or neurons in space and time, and boot up consciousness, then the only other way, you know, it's poverty of my imagination. The only other way I could think of trying to solve this problem is to say, well, okay, let me start with the theory of consciousness on its own terms, not as derived from anything else. Consciousness is fundamental. Try to get a mathematically precise theory of that, and then try to boot up space and time and, you know, neurons and computers and so forth. So I'm trying to go the other direction. And every scientific theory makes assumptions. And that sounds quite innocuous. Of course, assumptions, ho-hum. But really, assumptions are miracles for that theory. An assumption is a fact or a proposal that the theory is saying, please grant me this proposal. Please grant me this assumption. If you grant me this, I can explain all this other stuff. But the theory can't explain its own assumptions, right? The assumptions are the assumptions. So I like to call them miracles, because that's where explanation stops for that theory. Now, of course, you can always then try to get a deeper theory that explains the assumptions that you made in a prior theory. But the new theory will have its own new assumptions, right? There's no such thing as a theory of everything. And so my attitude about this is, right now, most of my colleagues are assuming space and time and physical objects like particles, protons and neutrons, and then bigger objects like neurons and brains. And they say, if you grant me space, time, and particles, I can explain all this other stuff, and I'll try to explain consciousness. But they failed to explain consciousness. So consciousness is, for them, still a mystery. So I'm saying, okay, grant me these assumptions about consciousness. I'll give you a mathematical model of consciousness, but I'm assuming that consciousness is fundamental. So yeah, it is a miracle, although I'm describing the miracle with mathematics, but it is a miracle. But if I can start there and then show how I can explain how space, time, and physical objects arise, then I have fewer miracles than them. Because for them right now, space, time, and particles are a miracle, and consciousness is a miracle. So by starting with consciousness as my only miracle and showing that I can get space, time, and particles, I have fewer miracles than them. So I'm better off. And so that's sort of how, you know, it's a long answer to the question, but that's why I decided to go at it this way. I'm trying to have fewer miracles than they have right now. But then later on, about 17, 18 years ago, I began a contemplative process of meditation, just pure silence, no particular orientation or religion or anything like that, just silence. And that, I think, has helped the development of my ideas. But it started first with the mathematics and the open problem in my field. But it's nice that the contemplative practice then feeds into it and helps me have more insights about consciousness, since that's now sort of the focus of my scientific study.
Can you expand on your theory for those who haven't read the book?
Right. So the idea is that space and time and particles like protons and neutrons and quarks and gluons are not the fundamental nature of reality. And that's a big leap, right? Physics for centuries has been about what happens inside space-time. That's what physics has been. And on evolutionary grounds that I can go into if you'd like, I realized that evolution by natural selection entails that we have to let go of space-time. It's not fundamental. And physical particles inside space-time can't be fundamental either. The very language of space-time can't describe objective reality. And so that was one reason why I was realizing that neurons and computation can't boot up consciousness. It's not even the nature of objective reality. So the proposal is that objective reality is like a vast social network of conscious agents, of consciousnesses. So it's a big social network, and where the science comes in is I have a mathematically precise definition of what a conscious agent is. Involves probability theory and Markovian kernels and so forth. And the network of agents is also a mathematically precise structure. It's multigraph theory and so forth. And so we're looking at dynamics on multigraphs and Markovian dynamics. But intuitively, what it's about is a vast social network of interacting conscious agents. And one of the interesting properties of it is that when agents interact, they create new agents. It just follows from the math. When two agents interact, their interaction satisfies the definition of a conscious agent. So it is a new conscious agent. That's just how you play this game. And so we get this vast network of conscious agents interacting, creating new agents. We have very, very simple agents that might only have one or two experiences, call them one-bit agents. But they can combine to create two-bit agents, four-bit agents, up to infinity. So we get infinite consciousnesses coming out of this theory, but we have mathematical controls. So it's when you have infinite consciousnesses, that's what most people would think is now you're in the realm of spirituality, which is very, very interesting. But we now have, for the first time that I know of, a mathematical theory. Now, I'm not saying it's right, but in fact, I'll say I'm probably wrong, but the point is to be mathematically precise so you can figure out precisely where you're wrong. So what's fun for me is, even though I'm probably wrong, for the first time that I know of, we have a mathematically precise theory of consciousness on the table in which consciousness itself is fundamental, not derived from neurons or microtubules and their collapses or causal computational structures of physical systems. It's consciousness on its own terms, and it leads naturally to a theory of infinite consciousnesses. And so for the first time, we have a precise theory of what we might call spirituality. Again, it's probably wrong, but at least it's precise, so we can now begin the scientific process of figuring out where it's wrong. And the interesting thing is that this theory then leads naturally to ways of booting up space-time and, I believe, all of quantum field theory and general relativity. We're working, my team is working on that, but the idea is to start with the dynamics of conscious agents and the long-term behavior, what's called the asymptotic behavior of conscious agents, is what physics is seeing. So they're not seeing, the reason it doesn't look like consciousness to them is they're not seeing the detailed dynamics of these conscious agents. They're only seeing the long-term behaviors. It would be like suppose you're flying in a helicopter over a bunch of busy roads. From your high point of view, you just see these dots moving along the streets and the freeways and so forth. And if you tried to model it, you might use, you know, differential equations and dynamical systems and so forth that have unconscious particles moving around on the streets. And you could model it that way, and it would be quite effective, like a fluid dynamics kind of model. What you're not seeing, though, from the helicopter's point of view, is that each one of those dots has a conscious being that's hitting the brake, turning the wheel, hitting the gas, doing all those things. And so you miss all that when you're looking at the long-term asymptotic behavior. And so that's what I'm proposing is going on here. The reason why physics has looked and not seen any consciousness is because they only get to look at the asymptotic behavior, the helicopter point of view. And that's no surprise, because they're starting not from consciousness itself, they're starting from what we can see. And all we can see in space and time, I'm proposing, is the asymptotic behavior. So that's why everywhere they look, they see no evidence of consciousness. Of course, when they look in the mirror, when they look at themselves, they have firsthand evidence of their own consciousness. And so that becomes a mysterious thing. How come everywhere we look with our scientific tools, we see no consciousness, but when I look in the mirror, I see consciousness staring me in the face? And so that's the dilemma that I'm trying to resolve with the theory of consciousness, where we understand how consciousness works with mathematical precision, and then explain why physics hasn't seen consciousness. And the reason is they only see the asymptotic behavior of consciousness, not the step-by-step detailed behavior of consciousness.
You mentioned that the theory presupposes that there are multiple consciousnesses or conscious agents interacting, and when they interact, they produce new agents. Do you mean that the interaction of the two agents is kind of like a collective consciousness between those two agents? And then eventually, if you add all of those up, there's some sort of a grand collective consciousness? Is that what you meant?
Yes, to a first approximation, that's the idea. The mathematics makes it possible that the new agent that arises from a dynamics of lower level agents could have completely different conscious experiences than any of the agents that compose it. So it's not a simple amalgamation. It's not just simply adding them together in some simple way. And I suspect that as we go into the mathematics of this, we're taking we have a theory based on something called Markovian dynamics on multigraphs. But some of my colleagues are working with me to use a new kind of mathematics called category theory to take this and move it to a more abstract kind of mathematical framework. So category theory and topoi. And the promise there is that we're going to see a wide variety of new kinds of ways that agents can combine. So my guess is that we're going to see that, yes, it is like a collective new consciousness, but there's going to be an incredible variety of ways that the new can arise. And it's going to be fun to explain and explore all those different ways. So I feel really excited, because, I mean, there's so much to learn here about how new consciousnesses could emerge and new varieties that right now I haven't even imagined. So
could you give some examples of this?
A concrete example in visual perception would be that we can have conscious agents whose perceptions are about just like black dots on a white screen in two dimensions. And something very, very simple like that. And if I show you several video frames of black dots on a white background, dots I just placed randomly from frame to frame, you'll just see random motion of the dots. In other words, when you combine all the low-level experiences of these agents that can just see single frames of dots, white black dots against a white screen, you'll just get more, you know, confusing black dots moving around against a white screen. But under certain conditions, if I choose the positions of the dots from frame to frame very, very carefully, in fact, satisfying a mathematical equation, a a second degree polynomial equation. Then magic happens. I show you that same video, and now you see a three-dimensional object like a sphere popping out in 3D or a cylinder. I can make you see whatever I want. We know how this works well enough that we can program it so that you see literally a new dimension of conscious experience. And you go from two dimensions to three dimensions, and you see, instead of just random motions of dots, you see a structure like a sphere or a cylinder or something like that. So, and clearly, when you're going from two-dimensional dots, just moving randomly and on a flat screen, to a rigid sphere rotating, that's not a mere amalgamation of the random dot motions, right? It's something different. Something new is happening. It's a new dimension of experience, 3D, but also a new coherence. A rigid object that's got this new property that couldn't actually appear in two dimensions. You cannot have a rigid 3D body in two dimensions. So this is literally a new conscious agent with a new qualitatively different kind of experience. And that's the kind of thing that we're seeing all around. So that the combination of conscious experiences and from interactions of conscious agents will lead not merely to adding these experiences together, this flat experience plus that flat experience gives me another flat experience. You add them together and you get literally a new dimension of experience, 3D versus 2D, and you get new structures in experience, like rigid objects, rigid spheres that you're not seeing in the flat, that you in fact couldn't see. And so that's pretty exciting. It really sort of we have to expand our minds about how consciousness works. And so this, I'm hoping, will feed back into spiritual traditions, right, that have been thinking about consciousness for thousands of years, but may not have realized that there are this potential infinite variety of ways that consciousnesses can combine and interact to create new kinds of consciousness. So it's open season. There's lots of stuff to explore.
One of the things that you talk about in your lectures and in your book is that we don't see reality as it is. We see reality according to our evolutionary fittedness. So we see things in a way that help us perpetuate our species. And one of the great examples that you give is the Australian jeweled beetle, where they are they're brown and kind of have these little pimples on them, and they're shiny. And so, you know, their prerogative is to look for other brown, shiny, pimply beetles, the bigger the better, and mate with them. And Australians have been producing these beer bottles that are brown, shiny, and pimply in just the right way, and, you know, bigger than a beetle. So beetles would swarm them, and you have these little videos showing and pictures showing this, and beetles would swarm them and try to mate with these bottles. And of course, what happens is they nothing happens. They don't reproduce, right, and they get fried in the sun and die. So...
Absolutely, and what's remarkable is that the male jewel beetles had found females successfully for thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years, maybe millions of years. So you would think that evolution had shaped their senses to know what a real female is, but apparently not, right? As you said, that's anything glossy, dimpled, and brown. And they, even when the beetles were crawling all over the bottles, so they had full embodied contact with these bottles, they could not shake the illusion. They continued to try to mate. And in fact, there were some ants that discovered this, and they would just eat the beetles alive. The beetles stayed on the bottles until death. So it's sad, sad story. But what that shows is that evolution... So now this is... taking evolution by natural selection as the theoretical context in which we're thinking, right? So, and I say that because that's how we work in science. We specify what theory we're using, and we then make our analysis of what that theory implies. And I'm not saying that evolution by natural selection is true. I'm not saying that my theory is true. But on the other hand, we have no better theory. For biology, we have at the present no better theory than evolution by natural selection, and evolution in general. So since there's nothing else on the table, we have to go with that. And it's a beautiful theory. I actually love the theory. It's incredibly beautiful, very, very powerful theory. And it entails some very counterintuitive results. And one of them is we tend to think that, you know, evolution has goals and the goal is us. We're the peak species of evolution, and it's about our intelligence. And as things go on, we will get more and more intelligent, bigger brains and so forth. And it turns out that that whole story is false, completely false. There's no aspect of it that's true. And from the point of view of evolution, there are no goals. The only goal, if there is a goal, if you want to speak that way, is getting your genes into the next generation. End of story. That's it. It's just sending genes into the next generation. But there's no goal for intelligence. In fact, we can talk about this if you wish. Our human brains have lost 10% of our brain volume in the last 12,000 years. We've lost the volume of a tennis ball, and we're on a continuing decline for reasons that are quite clear from evolutionary theory. So our species is actually downsizing its brain at a very, very rapid rate. And many species don't have brains, and they do just well. And some species use their brains, so the sea squirt, when it's a juvenile, has a fairly sophisticated nervous system that it uses to swim through the water to find currents that are fast enough but not too fast, with nutrients that are dense enough but not too dense. Once it finds the right habitat, it attaches itself to some fixed rock or something and stays there for the rest of its life. And now that it's done that search and found the right place, it doesn't need that sophisticated nervous system, so it eats it. And that's what evolution thinks about brains. If you don't need them, eat them. So there's nothing in evolution that says it's about bigger brains and it's not about us. And again, I'm saying this is what's entailed by evolution by natural selection. I'm not saying that this is deeply true, but we don't have a better theory right now. So we have to take, if someone doesn't like this, if they don't like these conclusions, great, come up with a better theory. But we have to have a better theory that can explain everything that evolution by natural selection explains and more. So that's what scientists are up to. So I don't think that science has ever yet come up with a true theory. But we've come up with marvelous theories. They're wonderful tools. And the burden on someone who doesn't like one of the theories is to do better. And that always means not accounting for less than you accounted for before, but counting for everything that you accounted for before and more. Or realizing that things that you accounted for before weren't important, and now you understand more deeply why they weren't important, so if you're not going to account for them. So one thing that evolution by natural selection entails that's very counterintuitive is that there are no selection pressures for any organism to ever perceive reality as it is. That's a stunning statement. I'll put it a different way. If a creature appeared that saw reality as it is, natural selection would stamp it out. The selection pressures are uniformly against seeing reality as it is. And that's true for all creatures and all senses. So it's remarkable. You might say, how in the world could you know that? And it turns out that evolution by natural selection is a mathematically precise theory. There was a mathematical biologist, a genius named John Maynard Smith, who figured out in the 1970s how to turn Darwin's idea into mathematics. And he used what's called game theory, and it's called evolutionary game theory. And there's an equation called the replicator equation. And so it's a very, very sophisticated mathematical system that we can use to prove theorems. So if you have a question like, does natural selection, does evolution favor creatures that see reality as it is, at least in part of reality? I mean, no one believes that we see all of reality, but most people would think we see those aspects of reality that are important for our survival. And so we see those parts of the truth. So you can put that question to evolution by natural selection. You don't have to wave your hands. You don't have to guess. You don't have to have ad hominem philosophical arguments about it. You can just look at the math and see what the math says. And the math is very, very clear. The probability is zero that any of our senses report any aspect of reality. I'll put it in a different way. It's that the very language of space and time and physical objects, shapes and colors and motions and smells and so forth, the very language of our senses is the wrong language to describe objective reality. You could not frame any true description of objective reality in that language, according to evolution by natural selection. The probability is zero that you could do that. So that raises the natural question, right? If that's what evolution has done, it's given us senses that don't show us the truth. Well, first, what good are they? What good are our senses? If they're not showing us the truth, now that sounds like they're worthless. So what has evolution given us? And I think the best metaphor is to think about evolution giving us not a window on the truth, but giving us a user interface like the desktop on your computer, right? If you're writing a paper and the icon for the paper that you're writing is blue and rectangular and in the middle of your screen, that doesn't mean that the paper, the document that you're writing, is blue and rectangular and in the middle of your computer. Anybody who thought that misses the point of the desktop interface. It's not there to show you the truth, which in this metaphor is all the circuits and software and, you know, voltages and magnetic fields inside your, you know, at the CPU and all that hardware and software. You don't want to deal with that hardware and software. That's way too complicated. That reality is a mess. If you had to toggle voltages to write a paper, you'd never get it done. And so what evolution gave us was a user interface that is specifically shaped to hide reality. Just like your desktop interface was specifically designed to hide the circuits and software so you don't have to deal with it. And just like an interface is designed to let you control the circuits and the software without even knowing what they are, that's what evolution has done with our space and time and objects perceptions. We see those not because they're the truth, but they let us control the truth while we're completely ignorant about the nature of the truth. It's simple, dumbed down interface that lets us do what we need to do to stay alive. And so that is a shock to our deeply held intuitive beliefs. We think that space and time, or their union, as Einstein gave us, into space-time, is fundamental reality. And that objects like the moon and protons and neutrons, objects in space-time, are aspects of fundamental reality. And that absolutely contradicts evolution by natural selection. You can't have both. Either it's true that evolution by natural selection is a correct theory, and therefore space-time is not fundamental, or if space-time is fundamental, then evolution by natural selection has made a false prediction, and so we need to change the theory. Both cannot be true. Maybe both are false, but both cannot be true. And so evolution by natural selection entails that space-time is doomed. It's not fundamental. And with it go all of its contents, all the physical objects, all the particles. They're not fundamental either, which is, again, one reason why I then turned my attention to consciousness, not as something trapped inside space and time, but just the reverse. Mm-hmm. Consciousness is the author of space-time. In computer science language, space-time is merely a data structure that we employ. It's our desktop interface. The desktop on your computer is two-dimensional. Space is your three-dimensional desktop. It's like a holographic desktop. And pretty soon, I would say within 10, 15 years, we'll have holographic desktops on our laptops as well. And it'll be all of a sudden when you're dealing with icons like a paint tool where you have a three-dimensional paintbrush that you can grab, all of a sudden the idea that three-dimensional objects are just data structures that we can employ to do what we need to do, to paint pictures and so forth. And we know that the 3D paintbrush that we're seeing is just an icon. It's a 3D icon, a very useful icon that lets us do stuff. Then we'll realize that, that the same is true of tables and chairs and the moon itself. The moon is just an icon. You create it when you look, and you destroy it when you look away. The same is true of space and time. They are, think about a virtual reality headset. When you have a virtual reality headset on and you're playing a game, like, you know, maybe a souped up version of some, you know, automobile race game, right? And so you look over and you see, say, a green Ferrari that you're racing. When you look over and you see it with your headset, you only see it because you're creating it in your mind when you look. When you turn your head the other way, you're getting different photons being sprayed to you by the headset, and now you're seeing a yellow Corvette. But that's because you're creating the yellow Corvette, and you destroyed the green Ferrari. So there is a reality. It's the game with the powerful CPU and all the software. But if you looked inside that reality in this metaphor, you wouldn't see any green Ferraris or yellow Corvettes. You would see circuits and software and CPUs, but there are no cars in there. And so that's what I'm saying. We render the moon when we look. We create the moon when we look. And we destroy it when we look away. There is an objective reality that we're interacting with when we create the moon, but it's utterly unlike anything we see. It's utterly unlike the moon. Just like there is a reality that you interact with in the VR case that you interact with when you create the Corvette, but it's utterly unlike a Corvette. And so this sounds strange to our generation, but I think the next generation that's raised on VR and spends a lot of time in VR that's as immersive and compelling as everyday life, it's going to be a no-brainer that when you take your headset off, you won't have to be that inquisitive to go, well, maybe this is just a headset too. Well, maybe I've had a headset on my whole life.
It's absolutely been my experience when playing video games. Like I'll have dreams playing video games. And as I'm navigating through a map, I'm recognizing that my brain is doing the exact same thing as when I'm walking in a new city. Like it's memorizing and I'm using the same kind of pathways to get through that space. And I'll have dreams as if I'm in that space for real. Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members.
Given the conclusions you're drawing or the theories you're drawing in this book, how has it affected your behavior out there in the world, and how has it affected your kind of perception about existential risks and this sort of thing we're facing in our current day and age? Has it changed your behavior at all?
Well, it in terms of my perceptions of the world, it's been very, very slow, because we didn't evolve. So now I'm putting on the evolution hat, right? So I'm not using the consciousness theory, I'm using the evolution by natural selection theory, right? So I should always tell you in what framework I'm talking, because otherwise it might sound like I'm contradicting myself, right? So from the point of view of evolution, there are no selection pressures for us to realize our state. If we take everything that we see as the truth, we're fine, right? So there's no selective advantage in, getting through the day during the Pleistocene for going, that rock that I'm seeing, it's not real. It's just my user interface icon. There were no selection pressures for that. And so that's why all of us are, from early on in our childhood, believe that what we see is the truth. Piaget, the very famous developmental psychologist, argued that we get what he calls object permanence when we're about 18 months of age. That the argument was that, if you take a 17-month-old child and show it a doll, it plays with the doll. And if you take the doll and put it behind a pillow, even while the child is looking, it doesn't see the doll anymore, and it acts as though the doll ceased to exist. I can't see it, therefore it doesn't exist. But after 18 months, he argued, we get what he calls object permanence. We get the insight that objects are real and exist even if we don't perceive them. So you put the doll behind the pillow and the baby crawls around and tries to get the doll from behind the pillow. It turned out that later experiments showed that Piaget was right, but it happens earlier than 18 months, probably around 4 months, that infants actually get this object permanence. So we've been shaped by evolution, according to Piaget and the developmental psychologist, to automatically get this belief that physical objects exist and persist even when they're not perceived. And we get it when we're 4 months old. So we can be excused if when we're grown up that it's hard for us to let go of something that was done to us before we could even argue against it. So, and it really takes like one of our best scientific theories, evolution by natural selection, and a theorem from that to sort of hit us in the face and go, whoa, maybe object permanence is not true. It's just something that evolution did to us, and it's not true. It's what we needed to stay alive, but we're not seeing the truth. So that's why I'm not surprised that even though I've been dealing with this kind of idea for many decades now, I've been at this for more than 30 years, thinking along this way. It's only been in the last few years, and maybe partly as a result of meditation, that I'm starting to live differently in my perceptions. As I drive, as I walk around, I'm starting to realize this is a headset. I'm starting to feel the headset for what it is. But it doesn't happen automatically. And most of the time, I'm back into, of course, I'm immersed in reality. But every once in a while, I get the experience of this is just a headset. Now, in terms of, you know, existential risks and so forth that you asked, and so forth, like right now we're all dealing with the coronavirus and so forth. Well, this does lead to an interesting question about what is death and how does death affect our consciousness? And in the framework of physicalism that most of my colleagues adopt and which I adopted, your consciousness is a product of your brain. Now, as I said, they don't have any theory about how that happens, but that's the assumption. Consciousness is not primary from their point of view. The brain and physical systems are primary, and if they have the right kind of complexity, then consciousness emerges. On that scientific assumption, it follows quite clearly that when you die and your brain dies, then your consciousness ceases. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. So physicalists do make important claims about human nature and the meaning of life and so forth. It's wrong to say otherwise. Science is making claims in areas where we say these are spiritual issues, like life after death. Physicalist science makes a very, very clear claim that there is no life after death. There's no consciousness after death. That's a very, very clear spiritual claim. Basically, that there is no spirituality after death. Nothing survives. In this theory that I'm working on, and again, I preface everything that I say. I mean, this is more important than the particular ideas that I'm actually proposing, is the attitude of course, I'm probably wrong. The whole point is to be precise so that we can figure out precisely where we're wrong. That's more important than anything else that I say, is the non-dogmatic attitude and the goal of being absolutely precise and being willing to walk away from deeply held theories. And that's more important than anything. And so in the model that I'm working on, in which consciousness is fundamental, that model, since it doesn't say consciousness arises from the brain, allows the possibility that the death of the body is not the death of your consciousness. Think of it this way. Suppose that you're playing, you go to a virtual reality arcade with some friends and you put on, you know, VR headset and bodysuit and you're playing virtual volleyball. You see a virtual court and balls and maybe it's on the beach, see trees and sand and so forth. And you play virtual volleyball for a while. And then one of your friends says, I'm thirsty. I need a drink, takes off his headset and bodysuit to get a drink. And his avatar collapses in the sand. it's for all purposes in the interface, in the VR interface, it's lifeless. But he's not lifeless. He just stepped out of the interface. And so the idea that space-time is not fundamental, that space-time is doomed, that physical objects are not fundamental, and the idea that consciousness is fundamental leaves open the idea that the death of a person's body is merely the avatar. We're only seeing the avatar in our space-time interface. That has ceased to interact with our interface, but the consciousness can still persist. Now, there are open questions, though, within that framework. Does yourself, with all of its memories, persist? Or is that sort of an optional add-on that may not persist? That is one of the interesting questions that I want to look at. And we, you know, we might have, we all have skin in the game. We might have outcomes that we would like. I would like to keep my memory of my family and my pets and so forth. But when we do the science, of course, we're human beings. We'll have our desires, but we've seen that humans have a consistent pattern of getting things wrong. We know what we want. We get it wrong, and we're consistent. We're 100% consistent at getting things wrong. And so that's why this non-dogmatic attitude of, okay, I know what I want it to be, but let's look at what the math, the logic, and the best evidence that we have is telling us. So we'll see. Right now, this theory is saying consciousness survives, but is it my, do I, my memory survive? I don't know. I'll be very interested. I mean, I've got skin in the game just like you, and I have what I'd like and don't like about that answer. But we just have to see where it leads. So it, and it does lead to interesting questions about morality that are very, very deep, and about spirituality. I mean, I mentioned that there are infinite conscious agents that come out of this. And not just one, but an infinite variety of infinite conscious agents, and probably an infinite variety of different levels of infinity. It turns out that there's not just one kind of infinity. There are bigger and bigger infinities. There's an infinite number of different infinities. And that's, a lot of people don't know that infinity is not just one thing, that there's a smallest infinity, which is the cardinality of like the integers, the numbers you can count. The natural numbers or the integers. And then there's the cardinality of the real numbers, which is a bigger one, and then you can keep going higher and higher infinities. And so it'll be interesting to explore, are there consciousnesses of all these higher levels of infinity? And if so, you know, this is going to be a mathematically precise theory of what we've called in various traditions something like God, or, you know, the highest, whatever it might be. But it'll be a mathematically precise thing. We can ask precise mathematical questions. How many infinite consciousnesses are there? Is there a single greatest infinite consciousness? What's the relationship between that consciousness and finite consciousnesses? How much can finite consciousnesses understand about the infinite consciousness? I mean, these are now technical questions that we can ask. So we can have a scientific spirituality. So I'm looking forward to that. It should be fun, because I think science and spirituality have been at odds for a long time, and I suspect that they will continue to be at odds, but the method of science and the spiritual insights from the spiritual traditions could come together. And of course, you know, I say that there are insights from the spiritual traditions, and I think there are, and of course there's also nonsense, just like there's nonsense in scientific theories. And so we have to use the method of being non-dogmatic, being precise, looking for data to test our theories, to find out what are the insights from the spiritual tradition, what's the nonsense, what's the insights from science, what's the nonsense. You know, for example, the idea that space-time is fundamental, I think, is nonsense. That's nonsense. It's the nonsense that's guided us for several centuries, is what we've believed, but it appears to be false. By the way, I should say, someone might say, well, look, this is a cognitive scientist. he's talking about space-time being fundamental. Now, surely the physicists will put him in his place, right? I mean, this is he's way out of his you know, roundhouse with this one. So what's going on? So it turns out I've used the phrase space-time is doomed several times. And that's because that's what several physicists are saying. So Nima Arkani Hamed, who's at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, has videos. If you Google space-time is doomed, you can actually hear it from the physicist himself. Mm. You don't need to take it from a cognitive scientist. You can hear it from a physicist. He's got very technical lectures, but he also has public lectures that are pretty understandable to a general audience, where he explains why physics is realizing that space-time cannot be fundamental, that it doesn't work, and that our very best theories, relativity theory, Einstein's theory of space-time, and quantum field theory, together, actually, those theories are telling us that space-time is only an approximate concept. It's not a fundamental concept. So it's, and I'll just give a hint of one of the ideas about why it's just approximate. When you try to measure things in space at finer and finer precision, like with a microscope, you know, but a really powerful microscope, there's something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which says that the smaller you look, the more energy it takes. And so that's no problem. You just crank up the energy, right? And we, you know, we can soup up more and more and look smaller and smaller. But then when there's a problem, when there's gravity, because at some point you put so much energy into such a small space when you're looking smaller and smaller that with gravity, you destroy space-time itself. You literally destroy space-time. You create a black hole. It happens at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. That's pretty small. So an atom is about 10 to the minus 8th centimeters. A proton is about 10 to the minus 14th centimeters. The innards of a proton, the quarks and gluons, are about 10 to the minus 17th centimeters. So 10 to the minus 33 is about as small compared to a proton as a proton is to us. So that's really small. But nevertheless, the mathematics of quantum mechanics and general relativity, when you put them together, entail that space-time ceases to be operationally usable concept after 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. It doesn't work.
So is that approximately what you would describe the size of a pixel in our interface?
Right. It you could think of it that way, but there is an important technical caveat on that. What the physicists are not saying that there are pixels of space-time. So they're not saying that. And the reason that they can't say that is sort of technical, but a pixel would have a fixed size, right? It would have a little size. And it turns out you can't do that and be what's called Lorentz invariant. So you couldn't have Lorentz invariant pixels. So we know that the idea, and no one, I think, wants to let go of Lorentz invariance when you're talking about space-time. So Lorentz invariance is what Einstein discovered when he discovered this, that nothing can go faster than the speed of light. When you actually cash out what it means to say nothing can go faster than the speed of light, you get what's called Lorentz invariance of space and time. That's sort of a technical thing. So there are no pixels. It's better to just say that the very concept of space and time disappear. Mm. They're no longer operational. It would be actually a wrong picture to think that there are just pixels at the smallest scale. But there is, you know, there is the Planck area, and there's something called the holographic principle, and it looks like a weird thing about space. And I'll say this because it will shake people's intuitions up. It'll make you think, okay, maybe everything I've believed is deeply false. So here's the idea. How much, if I had a volleyball, and I want to put data inside the volleyball, and I ask, you know, how much information could you stick inside the volume of that volleyball? You might say, well, I could put a 5 terabyte hard drive in there today, and next year maybe I could put a 10 terabyte hard drive. And so the question is there an in principle maximum amount of information you could stick inside the volume of that volleyball. And it turns out physicists have answered that question. And in fact, it was Stephen Hawking who answered that question. And he discovered there is a maximum limit, and it does not depend on the volume of the volleyball. It depends only on the surface area. The amount of information you can store into a region of space depends only on the area, not the volume. And if that hurts, if that seems really counterintuitive, then you understand the problem. Space is not a real container in which you stick stuff, like pouring milk into a glass. It's a data structure that you use that evolution is putting on the evolution hat. It's the data structure that we've evolved that lets us get through the day, and it's not the truth. And it's definitely not a pre-existing stage on which the drama of life plays out. So I'm saying space is not fundamental. Space-time is doomed. That means the Big Bang story, that the universe started with the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, that's not deeply true, because space-time is doomed. So space-time isn't the final reality. So the Big Bang, which is the origin of space-time in that story, can't be the final story. We need a deeper story. Whatever deeper story we come up with, and the one I'm working on with my colleagues is this network of conscious agents, what we have to show is how what looks like space-time emerges. We have to get back quantum field theory and general relativity. We have to show why it looks like there's a Big Bang. In other words, we can't just throw this stuff away. I mean, quantum field theory and relativity theory and all the science, I'm not saying, oh, it's all nonsense, throw it away. Absolutely not. I'm saying it's fantastic where it works, and it works in a lot of places, but it has limits, and so we need a deeper theory and a constraint on our deeper theory of consciousness. And this is what's really powerful. You know, how do you get a theory of consciousness? How do you get empirical data to constrain a theory of consciousness? Well, one source will be whatever theory of network of conscious agents that I propose or my team proposes and the dynamics. When we project it back into a space-time interface, we have to get back quantum field theory and general relativity and the Big Bang and evolution by natural selection as the projection of our deeper dynamics. If we can't do that, then our deeper theory of consciousness is wrong. So I'm not like saying some crank thing that, well, we're just throwing away all this, you know, centuries of science. Absolutely not. It's really important what we've got in science. It is a boundary constraint on a deeper theory. And if we can't get back our current science from a theory of consciousness, then we will have to modify our theory of consciousness. So that's the spirit in which I'm doing this.
What are some of the interesting experiments that you've done to demonstrate this theory in a kind of very simple and visceral way?
Well, we started on the evolutionary side of things. We started about 12 years ago. I started learning evolutionary game theory because I suspected that there was this result in evolution. And so a couple of my graduate students, Justin Mark and Brian Marion, actually ran evolutionary simulations. So we actually simulated creatures foraging for fitness payoffs, and we played with their perceptual systems. We allowed them to, some creatures to see all of reality and some not to see any of reality. And so we first got the idea that we could prove this result by doing hundreds of thousands of simulations. So if you actually use evolutionary game theory, and you can program this up on your own computer and, you know, and try it for yourself, you'll see that the creatures that see the truth will always die or, you know, be less fit compared to the creatures that are of equal complexity and see none of the truth and are just tuned to the fitness payoff. So you can actually see that for yourself. That was then what led me to go to a mathematician, and we've then proved the theorem. So we started with the simulations, we proved the theorem. But the other area is there's an area called psychophysics. It's a branch of science that's been around since 1860. And I've been doing psychophysical experiments myself since 1980. So for 40 years, I've been working on psychophysical experiments. And this is the scientific study of conscious experiences, where we literally get people in the lab. We have mathematically precise models of specific conscious experiences, and we test people in the lab. And so the example I gave you where you see a 3D sphere When I show you the 2D points moving on the screen, that's actually an area of research that I've spent many, many years studying. Human subjects, seeing how their conscious experiences flip from a flat experience to a 3D experience. And then testing, so we actually have mathematical models of exactly what the people in our labs should see, what our subjects should see. And so this is a concrete example of the kind of thing I'm talking about, where we can get mathematical models of consciousness. We literally can predict exactly what people are going to see and report, like using joysticks to report the depths that they're seeing and the objects that they're seeing. And I should maybe help people with another idea, and that is, I've been saying that our conscious experiences can be described mathematically. And that might seem really strange. How in the world could something as squishy and intangible as conscious experiences be described with mathematics? But it can, and the fact that it can is what allows virtual reality to work. Why is it that we can have a software system where you put on a headset and we immerse you in new worlds you've never seen before with creatures and shapes and so forth you've never seen before? It's because of the work that we've done in psychophysics. We know how your consciousness works with mathematical precision, and so we can play you. That's what we're doing in VR. With mathematical precision, we are playing with how you create conscious experiences. Effectively, we have gotten some insights into this idea about how conscious agents interact to create new conscious agents with new levels of conscious experiences, and we're playing that in VR.
So thank you. This has been a lot of fun. This has been great.
My pleasure. Thanks. Yeah. It's been great to talk with you, and take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's it for this episode. To get the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/123. To listen to the full conversation, head over to members.futurethinkers.org and register for the patron membership or higher. And remember, if you want to join Chris Beasley's workshop on overcoming the drive to always be busy, go to futurethinkers.org/busy and register for basic or premium membership. See you inside.
If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. Every month, we run a contest where we give away 1 month of the Future Thinkers membership for free. Check that out at futurethinkers.org/giveaway. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.